Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you, Chris. Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic called Big Book Tim. Incidentally, since I've left you, BigBookTim.com is back online, so you can go up there and listen to any of the talks besides the ones that I gave here. There's a bunch of them up there, and there's articles up there that I've written about controversial subjects in recovery. Imagine that, right? There's some links up there, and there's a contact form if you want to like ask questions or get in contact with me up there. So it's great to be back. You know, the last time I was here, I basically only got through the first seven chapters. And, you know, and I left the recording because I had to, business called me away, and I wanted to do a little more thorough job with the chapters, the forgotten chapters, as I call them. The chapters Two Wives, The Family Afterwards, the chapter to the employer and a vision for you. And, because I'm sure you've heard this in meetings before, you know, of well-intentioned folks, saying, that the program is the first 164 pages of the book, right? So, unfortunately, in those 164 pages, it talks about the stories, too. So, like, the program is the book. So, but ironically enough, even through people who are very, like, you know, the first 164, these four chapters rarely get talked about. Because their titles seem to imply that they're for other people. You know, and that hasn't been my experience. My experience is that these chapters apply to us as well. There's tons of useful information for helping other alcoholics, for improving our own program, our own spiritual growth. And so I felt that I wanted to be able to come and get into these chapters in depth as opposed to how I, you know, just kind of brushed over them, you know, because they're important to me. I really, you know, I believe that. So a little background on Chapter 2 Wives, page 104. It was not written by any wife. It was written by Bill Wilson. Originally, he approached Ann Smith, who was Dr. Bob's wife, and asked her if she would write the chapter. And Ann typically was quite a humble woman. The expression that we have in our book that we find over and over again is that faith without works is dead. It comes from the Bible. It's from James. Although that's an outside issue, it's an inside issue because it's in our book. So, and that was Anne's favorite quote from the Bible. So she would often say that, you know, it's real great to be pious. It's real great to pray and meditate and all that stuff. But if you're not coupling it with the action to go with it, it's just empty words, really, is kind of where it came. So, she declined to write it. And, instead of asking Lois to write it, Bill decided that he would write it. And, you know, and created, and as the result of that, basically created an entire fellowship, our sister fellowship, which is at the end of this chapter, as the result of that, you know, and his reasoning for that was, he wanted to keep it all the same writing style, you know, frankly, based on, you know, Lois had a book, it's hard to find. I mean, I had it at one point, but it was her diary of when they rode off to the eastern seaboard and all the states, called The Diary of Two Motorcycle Hobos. And it's her journal of their trip that Bill talks about, you know, that, you know, and she wasn't a victim. You know, she, like, it has that, you know, she definitely wasn't a hand wringer. She wasn't one of those women who were, you know, very timid and said, I mean, she was a tough woman, you know, and she drove the Harley most nights too. So, kind of with her drunk husband in the sidecar. And, you know, and she was really strong. She was a strong woman. I mean, she went through, she went to work. We read that in Bill's story. She had to go to work. You know, they couldn't have children. She was pregnant early on in their marriage, and she lost the baby. And as the result of that, she had to have a full hysterectomy, and they couldn't have children. So there was a lot of bitterness in her life. And then here she is married to this guy, too, you know, who, had his, I guess the best way is his philandering is pretty, well known, I guess we would say. That's the best way. But, you know, despite that, she still stayed with him. She got her revenge, as I like to say, after his death, with the writing of the Living Sober book. It was written by her good friend, Barry L. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's mentioned in the third tradition, tradition three. He's the person that talks about that there was a stigma or a disease that's even a bigger stigma than alcoholism. And the irony of that is at the time, those were true statements because he was a homosexual and it was a disease that was in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mood Disorders, just like alcoholism. I mean, it was there for years, and it's only of the last two editions of that book that it has been removed. So he wasn't speaking out of turn. He was, you know, being appropriate for the times. So it's the only book in AA that's not of the grapevine that was written by somebody other than Bill Wilson. Okay, and it was almost like a dig to him after he was gone because Bill kind of blocked things, you know. Notoriously, the meditation book that's put out by a different company that most of us know was written by someone in AA. It was published in 1956, and you know Bill put the kibosh on that. Nobody was, you know, because he wasn't getting any royalties and it wasn't his words, that sort of thing. So, despite how much I love this book and how much it helps people, and you know, Bill was a brilliant man. But he was also an alcoholic, you know, with all the same flaws that we have of that egomania and just the brilliance of who he was. And he felt that he, you know, hey, this is my thing, you know, and especially after Dr. Bob had died. And so, you know, and as I mentioned at the end of this chapter, there is an endorsement. It's the only one in our book, ironically, for another fellowship. And I'm a member of that fellowship as well. And so this chapter basically applies to anyone who is a spouse. I mean, at the time, there's a footnote here at the bottom. It says, written in 1939 when there were few women in AA, this chapter assumes that the alcoholic in the home is likely to be the husband. But many of the suggestions given here may be adapted to help the person who lives with a woman alcoholic, whether she is still drinking or is in or is recovering in AA. A further source of help is noted on page 121. Like I said, that's the end of the chapter. Okay, so based on, you know, the chapter Two Wives, because there was very few women in AA at the time. So he says, with few exceptions, our book has thus far spoken of men, but what we have said applies quite as much to women. Our activities in behalf of women who drink are on the increase. There is every evidence that women regain their health as readily as men if they try our suggestions. But for every man who drinks, others are involved. The wife who trembles in fear of the next debauch, the mother and father who see their son wasting away. Now, obviously, you can flip that around. The husband who's doing that, and the mother and father who see their daughter wasting away. You know, there's a lot more women in AA. A lot more now. And sometimes you have both. Sometimes this chapter applies to the couple. That, you know, because I've heard so many times that, you know, people, they were drinking buddies. And they got married, and then they came to AA, and then they both got sober, and then they were MFing each other, and, you know, and that's, no, you, and you're sponsor, and I'm calling your sponsor, you're calling my, you know, and it just becomes all that, you know. So, it's important to recognize that it's not just two wives, although some of it, has a bit of condescension to it because it was written by a man in a perspective of kind of defending his stuff. So we'll get to that though. Among us are wives, relatives, and friends whose problem has been solved. Now, for those of you who haven't heard me rant for 18 weeks, the problem has been solved. Okay. If you go through this process, you become recovered. And that's the solution. So if you're living in the solution, the problem doesn't exist. So the problem has been solved, right? As well as some of us who have not yet found a happy solution. There's a lot of those people in AA, unfortunately. We want the wives of Alcoholics Anonymous to address the wives of men who drink too much. What they say will apply to nearly everyone bound by ties of blood or affection to an alcoholic. Now, that's extremely important, that statement. What they say will apply to nearly everyone bound by ties of blood or affection to an alcoholic. Okay, so ultimately, this chapter can be for everyone, right? That sister fellowship that we have, their qualification for membership, like ours is a desire to stop drinking. Their qualification is that a friend or a family member is affected by alcoholism. Well, hello, that's everyone. It's everyone, right? I was thinking about this. Think about the math, right? The experts, the professionals say that 20% of America is addicted in some form or another to alcohol, drugs, what it may be, right? So they say right here, okay, for every one person who is the affected person, it affects four people, right? So now we just said 20% of America. Well, that's 60 million, right? So it affects four people for every one of those 60 million. So 60 million times four is 240 million. Well, there's 300 million Americans. Okay, so what? There's 20% that aren't affected? I doubt that. They're probably, like 10% of that is probably in denial. You know, or, so basically, like, we have 300 million people in this country and 240 million of them are affected. So, it kind of applies to everyone, doesn't it? So I think they should start running 5K races for us. And I think they should paint lines down the middle of roads. And I think we should paint fire hydrants different color. You know, like, okay. Because it affects all of America. All of America. All right. So, he goes on to say, as wives of Alcoholics Anonymous, we would like you to feel that we understand as perhaps few can. We want to analyze mistakes we have made. We want to leave you with the feeling that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. Now, at the time, Alcoholics Anonymous was made up quite differently. It was inclusive. Couples were encouraged to be at meetings together. Both husband and wife went through the program together. They went through the process at the time of what we do. More of the six-step process, because as some of you may know, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was a birth from the Oxford group, and it was a Christian-based organization that dealt with a thing called the Four Absolutes. And from that came our, a six-step program to overcome alcoholism, and from that we have our 12 steps of today. So, there was not just alcoholics in a room. There was alcoholics and wives in the room. And the wives at the time were quite valuable, okay, because they had a measure of understanding of religious aspect and spirituality that the men did not. Okay, it became very natural for the early women of AA because most of them were involved with the Oxford group in the first place. Okay, so it was a natural jump for them to be involved in the process of recovery. So it was put out there. Now, the interesting thing about this, Bill talks about we want to analyze mistakes we have made. That's sort of a confessional. And this, you know, I've talked about this before. This book went out to people. It didn't just stay with a bunch of people who were recovered drunks. It went out to authorities throughout the country. People had feedback. The wives had input to it. They got to read what was going on, and they had objections to it. And they said, okay, this was okay. That's not okay. So it was in there. But so try to keep an open mind of the prospect of if you are dealing with someone in your own life who is affected by alcoholism, okay, not necessarily a spouse, not just a significant person in your life, maybe even someone that you sponsor, okay, because it's important to look, because that's what this is. Everything beyond chapter 6 is all 12-step work. Chapter 7 is working with others. This is a 12-step work about spouses. So the next chapter is a 12-step chapter about family. The next one after that is a 12-step chapter about employers. The next one about after that is, you know, what we're bringing out to the world. Okay, so it's all about carrying the message of recovery. Right? So he goes on. He says, we've traveled a rocky road. There is no mistake about that. We've had long rendezvous with hurt, pride, frustration, self-pity, misunderstanding, and fear. These are not pleasant companions. We have been driven to maudlin sympathy, to bitter resentment. Some of us veered from extreme to extreme, ever hoping that one day our loved ones would be themselves once more. Our loyalty and the desire that our husbands hold up their heads and be like other men have begotten all sorts of predicaments. We have been unselfish and sacrificing, self-sacrificing. We have told innumerable lies to protect our pride and our husbands' reputations. We have prayed. We have begged. We have been patient. We have struck out viciously. We have run away. We have been hysterical. We have been terror-stricken. We have sought sympathy. We have had retaliatory love affairs with other men. Okay, so in that paragraph, Bill is really recognizing what the women go through, right? And saying, hey, you know, okay, we get it. We've done some bad stuff and our behavior and all that, you know, affects you. So he's kind of putting it out there, letting you know, like, listen, if you're feeling this and you're reading this and you're feeling this, we know what you're going through. We've all gone through that. That's what he's saying there. Now, kind of flip it around and think about it from a male perspective too. Okay? That all applies to men as well. Right? I know personally I've been through that. You know, the protection, that protecting thing is huge. That's a huge issue of like, I talk about this all the time because it's one of the most difficult things that we do as recovered alcoholics is allowing other people to have their journey, have their path, fall down, hit their bottom without protecting them. Okay, that's one of the hardest things that we have to do. And the hardest part about that is that if we believe we have a higher power of our own understanding that takes care of everything in our life, that's all powerful in our own life, that means everyone else has one. Including the person who we're yeah-butting about. Right? That we're telling lies for. That we're protecting. For their own good. Right? That we strike out viciously against. That we yell at. Like, it's just so hard because it's the most amazing thing that we do the same thing to other alcoholics that people have done to us. It's truly phenomenal that that goes on. And it's just, it's a very difficult thing because it involves emotions. Right? So that's why I always talk about when I do, you know, we're dealing with facts. We want to deal with facts. We don't want to deal with feelings. Because feelings screw the facts up all the time. Right? Because ultimately, if you look at this, the facts are, right, 90% of the time, somebody who is sick and stuck in their addiction of any kind, their alcoholism, they are sick people and they need, one, hospitalization if they want to overcome it. Two, if they don't want to overcome it, they don't want to do anything about it, they need to leave. Those are facts, okay? But then our feelings come in about them. Well, maybe I could take care of them. Maybe if I keep an extra eye on them, maybe if I lock the doors, if I put an alarm on and they try to leave at night, I'll know. You know, maybe if I get rid of everything that has alcohol in the house, get rid of extracts, get rid of this, get rid of bread because then they can make alcohol, you know, just, right? All this insanity because it's all based on feelings. Okay, so the facts are, because we don't argue with people who are having a heart attack. Okay? We call 911, we get their ass in the ambulance and they're going to the hospital. That's it. But with alcoholism and other addictions, well, our head and our heart and arguments, we wanna, it's not really and it's that, and because we don't look at it, we don't deal with it as an illness. Still, we look at it as a behavioral problem. Right? It's an illness that causes behavioral problems. Right? So, he continues, he says, our homes have been battlegrounds many an evening. Not mine, I've never experienced that. In the morning, we have kissed and made up. Right? How common is that? I mean, with sober people, that's common, right? Our friends have counseled chucking them in, and we have done so with finality, only to be back in a little while hoping, always hoping. Our men have sworn great solemn oaths that they were through drinking forever. We believed them when no one else could or would. Then in days, weeks, or months, a fresh outburst. Right? I mean, those are facts. We've experienced those things. At least 90% of us. You know, and then if you're in recovery, if you're fortunate enough to be in recovery and you're not married or not in a relationship, when you get into one, hopefully you won't have to experience that. Okay? But there is the possibility that that's going to happen. Because that's what we attract. We attract sick people. Right? Until we are absolutely well, there's just something about our, we can fix. I can fix you. Right? And all you could really do is fix them a drink. Yeah. So, okay. We seldom had friends at our homes, right? Never knowing how or when the men of the house would appear. We could make few social engagements. We came to live almost alone. When we were invited out, our husbands sneaked so many drinks that they spoiled the occasion. If, on the other hand, they took nothing, their self-pity made them killjoys. Well, that works the other way, too. I've experienced it. It worked. It's not like, oh, it's just men. Women too. There was never financial security. Right? Positions were always in jeopardy or gone. An armored car could not have brought the pay envelopes home. The checking account melted like snow in June. Okay, I have an ex-wife who's not, she's an earth person, believe it or not. And my bank account melted like snow in June. All the time. Okay? But she was an untreated diabetic. Okay? So it kind of has the same feeling to it. Not taking care of her illness, and as the result of that, trying to fill it with other things. Spending needlessly. Where's the rent? You know? Like, well, you're supposed to make it. Okay. I did. It was in the bank. You know, those are the same types of conversations that alcoholic couples have all the time. Well, I just can't seem to hold on to money. You know, just on and on and on, right? Sometimes there were other women. How heartbreaking was this discovery? How cruel to be told they understood our men as we did not. Flip it around. I've been on the other end of that. And your expression is, what? 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 What are you talking about? What? Because it's just unfathomable to us that the preceding paragraph of, you know, being unselfish and self-sacrificing. And then we get this in return? How dare you? Right? Because that's what happens. I mean, it's real. It's tough to sit in this. It's tough to go, wow, this stuff is like right on, man. You know, because it makes you angry. It makes you feel like, drunks, right? Okay, the bill collectors, the sheriffs, the angry taxi drivers, the policemen, the bums, the pals, and even the ladies they sometimes brought home. Our husbands thought we were so inhospitable. Joy killer, nag, wet blanket. That's what they said. Next day, they would be themselves again, and we would forgive and try to forget. Right? Because that's all feelings. That's all emotion-based. We try to forgive and we try to forget. The facts are, we'll never forget. Those are the facts. I dare anybody to produce forgetting some sort of liaison that their significant other may have had. To forget it. I challenge you to tell me when you forgot it. Right? You may have forgiven it. You may have gotten to that place. If God has let you in and you did an inventory about it, and you were honest with it, and put it there, you may have gotten to forgiveness, but you're never going to forget. That's just our nature, right? Because we protect ourselves. We don't want to be hurt. You know, I don't even think, you know, Gandhi didn't forget things that went on. You know, it's just, and he was a pacifist, you know. So, okay, we have tried to hold the love of our children for their father, right? We have told small tots that their father was sick, which was much nearer the truth than we realized. They struck the children, kicked out door panels, smashed treasured crockery, and ripped the keys out of pianos. I've never experienced that. They must have been strong. In the midst of some pandemonium, they may have rushed out threatening to live with the other woman forever. In desperation, we have even got tight ourselves. The drunk to end all drunks. The unexpected result was that our husbands seemed to like it. Right? I mean, you know, I've been sober a long time. So, you know, I've been with women who are like, can't you just have one? It would just be so much better if you could drink. Yeah, you think so, huh? It's like, would you like a phone number or two? Perhaps at this point we got a divorce and took the children home to father and mother. Then we were severely criticized by our husband's parents for desertion. Usually we did not leave. We stayed on and on. We finally sought employment ourselves as destitution faced us and our families. Again, a little nod to Lois there, because she picked up his pieces for him, right? We began to ask medical advice as the sprees got closer together. The alarming physical and mental symptoms, the deepening pall of remorse, depression, and inferiority that settled down on our loved ones. These things terrified and distracted us. As animals on a treadmill, we have patiently and wearily climbed, falling back into exhaustion after each futile effort to reach solid ground. Most of us have entered the final stage with its commitment to health resorts, sanitariums, hospitals, and jails. Sometimes there was screaming delirium and insanity. Death was often near. Now, I don't know how many of you have experienced those types of things. It's not fun. It's not pretty. It really is heart-wrenching to get to a point where you know that this person that you care about, that you have deep emotional ties to, are killing themselves slowly, that they are close to death, that they shake right in front of you. After a few hours of having not drank, maybe passing out the night before and being up 6 hours later and shaking because they need a drink. Screaming at you about something that you never did, that you weren't even in the country at the time, maybe, you know, like that, on that level. These are realities. It's a tough thing to deal with. So it's important to have this there. It's important to recognize this as recovered and recovering alcoholics, that it's reality, right? I talk about this all the time when I go through this, that we're on a life and death errand. This isn't like, you know, a weekend seminar. You know, this isn't part of a group, you know, that wants you to just think differently. This is, we need to do this stuff or we're going to die. And sometimes we face this in our own lives with significant others and people that we love and people that we care about. They're going to die. I've seen tons of people die from this illness. It's just, it's the reality, right? Okay, under these conditions, we naturally made mistakes. Right? Some of them rose out of ignorance of alcoholism. Sometimes we sensed dimly that we were dealing with sick men. Had we fully understood the nature of the alcoholic illness, we might have behaved differently. Right? That's a pretty powerful statement. And even us, even those of us who understand the alcoholic illness don't behave differently. Because it's not happening to us. It's not happening to somebody that we have no emotional ties to. Right? It's happening to the person we love. Right? That we love, that we make commitments to, that make commitments to us. Right? It's powerful. It's a sad thing. Okay, but we need to recognize it, because how does it work, right? If we don't admit that there's a problem, we're never going to accept that there's a problem, and then we're never going to take action against it. So without that process, you know, if we're just going, no, it's different, and that's where our self-delusion usually comes in, right? That it's different because it's my significant other, it's my husband, it's my wife, so it's different, so I'm different than who they're talking about in this book. They don't understand. Phil wrote it. What does he know? He's not a woman. He's not a wife. Right? He doesn't know. But so far, I haven't really hit on anything that I haven't experienced on the other side as a man. Right? I'm sure there's people in here who've experienced these feelings. And there's, you know, the thing about alcoholism that's hard, like, when we're in AA as members of Alcoholics Anonymous and people come in and we try to help them to recovery, there's a different mindset. We're able to kind of keep a distance to a point of understanding and expecting the lies that are coming out of their mouth. We get it. We're like, because it talks about that early on in the book, It says, you know, and they may tell the truth from time to time. Okay? I mean, how many times do we deal with that as members of Alcoholics Anonymous? We say things like, listen, you know how I know you're lying? Your lips are moving. That's how I know you're lying, right? But yet when we get to this part of our lives, because it's so intimate, it's all the knowledge that we have, all our experience goes out the window. The most spiritual one of us, when it comes to helping people who are not connected to us, become ridiculously unhealthy, become ridiculously codependent, become ridiculously enabling, and we turn into the newcomer in recovery. Right? So that's why we need to recognize this. We need to treat this side of our alcoholism. That's why it addresses it. And it's going to get into some of the things that we need to address as alcoholics. Right? All by itself. Okay. How could men who love their wives and children be so unthinking, so callous, so cruel? Okay? Well, let's change the gender. How could women who love their husbands and children be so unthinking, so callous, so cruel? Right? That's real too. There could be no love in such persons, we thought. And just as we were being convinced of their heartlessness, they would surprise us with fresh resolves and new attentions. For a while, they would be their old sweet selves, only to dash the new structure of affection to pieces once more. Asked why they commenced to drink again, they would reply with some silly excuse, or none. It was so baffling, so heartbreaking. Could we have been so mistaken in the men we married? Could we have been so mistaken in the women we married? Right? When drinking, they were strangers. Sometimes they were so inaccessible that it seemed as though a great wall had been built around them. Right? I mean, those are real words. It's very powerful. Baffling and heartbreaking. And yet what's, again, it goes back to, even as recovered alcoholics and recovering alcoholics, we know why they drink again. We know it. And we're still baffled. How could you know, you've been to AA. You've been in AA for 10 years. How could you relapse? Right? And we know what my answer is to that. And for those of you who don't know that, the answer to that is, obviously the reservation that they had showed up. Okay? Because that's what I've been saying. You've heard me say it. I'll continue to say it. That's why people drink. They had a reservation, and the reservation showed up. And they were forced to drink. It wasn't because they stopped going to meetings. It wasn't because they didn't call their sponsor. It was none of that. It's because they had a reservation that they said, I won't drink unless this, or if this happens. And it happens. And now they're screwed. Okay? Unless they get the grace of God that comes in and turns them away from that choice. I mean, that's what AA is about. Grace of God. That's it. That's the only thing that stops us from making the wrong turn. Every time. Still, 22 years later, I'm going to make the wrong turn without God. Tell her, because lack of power is my dilemma. I don't have any power to make the right decisions. I make the wrong ones all the time, in sobriety, because God's not in it. When God's in it, I make the right decisions all the time when God's in it. It's amazing how that happens. Like when I'm trying to, oh my God, oh, I have to, she's got to, right? And then when I just say, you know what, God, you take care. You take care, because I can't handle this crap. And then something happens. I get a little serenity. Just a little bit. Right? And then I start worrying again. And then I gotta go through, oh, you take care of her. And I get a little serenity. And then I start worrying again. You know, because that's what happens. Right? Okay, because they're strangers. Right? When drinking, they're strangers. We have no idea who the hell they are. And the sad thing about it is that sometimes even in sobriety, we don't know who that person is. Right? We're like, who the hell are you? Where'd you go? Where's the person I started dating? Where'd they go? What happened to them? Where are they? Right? That happened to me when I got married. Okay? I didn't live with my ex-wife before I got married. We got married, went on our honeymoon, came back, and a different woman was there. Right? I was like, what did you do with my wife? I was blindsided. It was amazing. She was completely different. She was not the person who I spent 2.5 years getting to know and talking about life and what we're going to do. She was like, okay, I got you now, and some things are going to change. Oh, my God, what a nightmare it was, right? And then, so then I became a diabetic because she wasn't taking care of herself. So I learned all about it. Okay, just replace that with alcoholism. It's the same thing, right? And then even in recovery, I've been involved with people who relapsed. So now what? They relapsed, so now I got to break up with them? You know, because those are really the facts. Those are the facts. You relapsed, because, you know, you go into that with that, you know, that puffiness, with that gutter bravado, you know? If, you know, we're together, we're in recovery together, and if you ever relapse, that's it. Right? And then what happens? They relapse, and now you're like, well, I didn't really mean that to you. I mean, like, you know, that's it. You have to do something about it, you know. Right? Because that's what goes on. Because that's it doesn't really mean that's it. Right? So then what happens? So then you get on that treadmill that he's talking about. You're patiently, wearily climbing. Oh, okay. I'm with you. I'm supportive. I'll be there for you. And then all of a sudden, crash. Right? But then there's the other side. You know, it's describing what could happen. I've experienced people who that happened. There were relapses in their life. There were relapses as couples. The person who relapsed got sober. They led the person who did not relapse generally went to that other fellowship to start dealing with these issues. And that person got well again. Their partnership got stronger. There was forgiveness involved. Because it was only about the alcoholism. There wasn't like outside issues that went on. There wasn't liaisons. There wasn't infidelities. There wasn't those things that happened. It was just their illness kicked their butt. Right? So there is that hope. You know, I don't want anybody to think like it's okay to relapse. You know, because I don't believe that. I believe that you may not have another recovery in you. Right? Could be death. Or worse. Right. Right. Okay. And even if they did not love their families, how could they be so blind about themselves? Right. What had become of their judgment, their common sense, their willpower? Why could they not see that drink meant ruin to them? Why was it when these dangers were pointed out that they agreed and they got drunk again immediately? Right. And why? We all know why. Because they usually just agree to shut us up. Oh, yeah, you're right. I can't do this anymore. I have to quit. Are you done? I have to be done. Right? I have to. Nobody has to be done. Right? You're either done or you're not. That's how it works. Okay? These are some of the questions which race through the mind of every woman who has an alcoholic husband. We hope... Oh, what's this say? This book has answered some of them. Perhaps your husband has been living in that strange world of alcoholism where everything is distorted and exaggerated. You can see that he really does love you with his better self. Of course, there is such a thing as incompatibility, but in nearly every instance, the alcoholic only seems to be unloving and inconsiderate. It is usually because he is warped and sickened that he says and does these appalling things. Today, most of our men are better husbands and fathers than ever. Okay? Now, flip that around gender-wise. It's very true on that side, too. Right? I've experienced that. I've watched... I know one man. I sponsored a guy whose wife struggled for years. I mean, years she struggled with her alcoholism. And everybody told him the same. Hey, come on, man, you know, what's going on? You gotta get rid of her. Why don't you start dating? Why don't you this and why don't you that and that and that? And to his credit, he took care of himself. He took care of their son. He took care of the house. Did what he needed to do. Detached himself from that situation. Allowed her to have her journey. Would make decisions. Put her in her own apartment someplace at one point. Because that's where she needed to go. He couldn't have her around their son this way anymore. And I remember sitting across the table from him one time saying, and asking him point blank these questions. Well, why aren't you getting divorced? I'm not ready to be divorced. Okay. Why aren't you dating that everybody's telling you to date? I don't want to date. Okay. Well, you must love her. Yeah, I think I do. I said, well, it's not even a matter of think. It's your actions that are doing that. Okay, so, I mean, that was like 2 years before his wife got sober. Right? Now, she was one of those people, again, they were sober together. She relapsed and then struggled for years. Years, because she had outside issues as well that she wasn't taking care of. Right? And then she got sober. And I can remember him celebrating his anniversary 2 years after that. And she had been sober for 2 years. And here are the three of them sitting there at his anniversary. He's sober. She's sober. Their son is doing... It was just like... It was a miracle of God sitting there in front. And I was just so happy. I was like, oh, look, it works. I'm like, yeah, we have a happy ending from chapter two wives. Yeah, you know, like... That's what went through my head. And, you know, of course, people thought I was crazy. Because most of the time I am, right? All right. Right. Oh, so, and as the result, I mean, she was an example of, she became a better mother than ever. Right? Much better. Try not to condemn your alcoholic husband no matter what he says or does. Okay, I'm going to call BS on that one. He is just another very sick, unreasonable person. Treat him when you can as though he had pneumonia. When he angers you, remember that he is very ill. Okay. And then after that, make sure that you go to the monastery and sit around and go, oh, and bang gongs. Okay. I mean, it's a little outlandish on this one. You know what I mean? Like, you know, good luck. Right? There is an important exception to the foregoing. We realize some men are thoroughly bad intentioned. That no amount of patience will make any difference. An alcoholic of this temperament may be quick to use this chapter as a club over your head. Don't let him get away with it. If you are positive he is one of this type, you may feel that you had better leave. Is it right to let him ruin your life and the lives of your children? Especially when he has before him a way to stop his drinking and abuse if he really wants to pay the price. He's got a solution. It's right here. It's in this book. This is the book. Here's the solution. Oh, you don't want to do this? Get out. Out. Get out. Yeah, I know, but you don't understand. Right? Because it becomes this thing, like, and it's really hard for people who are in recovery, like, because we all know, right, that our lives as ex-alcoholics depend on constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Okay, so that's what he's talking about here. Don't let him try to spin it around like, oh, well, who's the unselfish one over here? Oh, what am I supposed to do? You know, I don't have any money. You know, I have a job, a place to go. Right? Okay, that's the club that he's talking about. Okay, well, you have a solution. Yes, I understand all of that, but here's the solution to stop your drinking and your abuse. Isn't that cool that he wrote that in there? His abuse. We don't see that word anywhere else in this book. His abuse. Right? Her abuse. Because that's what it is. It's mental and emotional abuse. Right? Sometimes it's neglect. Sometimes it's physical and sometimes it's sexual. It's abuse involved. That's how it is. Okay, so if he wants to pay the price, and we know, as recovering alcoholics and recovered alcoholics, what the price is to pay, right? Okay. The problem with which you struggle usually falls within one of four categories. Okay, now he's going to give a description, four descriptions. The first one is of a certain type of hard drinker, right? And if we go back further in the book, we could see that certain type of hard drinker. The three, two, three, and four are alcoholics. Okay, so that's the difference. And it even says it. One, right? Your husband may only be a heavy drinker. Next page, right? The world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. Some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number of them will become true alcoholics after a while. Okay, so basically with a lot of hard work, a heavy drinker can become an alcoholic. All right, number two. Lack of control. Showing lack of control. Unable to stay on the waterway. Entirely out of hand when drinking. Admits this is true, positive that he will do better. Has begun to try with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating, staying dry, beginning to lose his friends, business is suffering, spiral starts. Sometimes drinks in the morning, day through the day, nervousness, remorseful after, tells you he wants to stop, right? These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say among ourselves, he wants to stop. Okay? That doesn't mean, like, you know, there's this misnomer of a functioning alcoholic. Right? There's no such thing as a functioning alcoholic. Okay? It's somebody who has not yet gotten to the point of alcohol dependence. There are functioning alcohol abusers. Okay, but the definition of somebody who is alcohol dependent, somebody who suffers from that illness, is it interferes with normal functioning. So if something interferes with normal functioning, you're not a functioning alcoholic. Okay. Number three. Gone much further than husband number two. Though once like number two, he became worse. Imagine that. His friends slipped away. His home is near wreck. He cannot hold a position. Maybe the doctor has been called in. And the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. He admits he cannot drink like other people. But he does not see why. Okay, so he's in that denial thing, right? He clings to the notion that he will yet find a way to do so. Right? Reservation. Lurking notion. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. That's because he's addicted to it. He's dependent on it. Right? His case presents additional questions which we shall try to answer for you. You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. Why? Because there's tons of us in Alcoholics Anonymous who fall into that category. And we've overcome the drinking, and we have recovered, and we live productive lives that were way better than when we were drinking, and sometimes better than people who are earth people, who are non-alcoholics. Right? Four. May have a husband of whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. He's violent, appears definitely insane when drunk. Sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital. Perhaps he has delirium tremens. Doctors may shake their heads and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you have already been obliged to put him away. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands have gone just as far, yet they got well. Right? All right. Let's now look back at husband number one. And he says, oddly enough, he's often difficult to deal with. He enjoys drinking. It stirs his imagination. His friends feel closer after a highball. Perhaps you enjoy drinking with him yourself when he doesn't go too far. You have passed happy evenings together chatting and drinking before your fire. Perhaps you both like parties, which would be dull without liquor. You could just leave, right? We've enjoyed such evenings ourselves. We had a good time. We know about liquor as a social lubricant. Some, but not all of us, think it has its advantages when reasonably used. Okay, that's a bit of a stretch. Most people that I know who are in recovery don't like to be around people who use alcohol as a social lubricant. Because usually it means they're going to go too far with it. Okay? Or it may affect them. I know for me, I have such a high sensitivity to alcohol now. I mean, I don't use red wine vinegar because it affects me. I mean, that sort of thing. I dated this woman who was a borderline heavy drinker. She was really working on it, you know. And one night after we had gone out, you know, she had been drinking, and we were kissing. And the next morning, I felt weird. I felt like almost hungover because, you know, 10% of alcohol is absorbed in your cheeks, another 10% in your esophagus, and another 40% when it's heading down, right? So before it even gets down in there, it's already affecting me. So the alcohol was in her saliva. Sorry to be descriptive, but that's how it was. And it affected me in such a way that I was like, listen, you know, like, if you're going to be drinking, that's great. I have no problem. You can drink all you want, but don't be expecting to kiss me because it makes me sick. And then it became an argument, right? Oh, I'm like, listen, it doesn't make me sick in a judgmental way. It makes me physically ill. I cannot have it. I'm allergic to alcohol. Do you understand that? Well, you're just being selfish and all that. Needless to say, we're not together. But, so, I don't know if anybody else experiences that. That's my experience with it. So I generally, you know, I avoid women who drink. It's just not, you know, it's not a choice that I like to have. You know, it's fine. I should say I avoid women who drink as partners. Because, you know, people who drink are fine with me. I don't care. You know, that's their thing. So, and then he says, this is one of the things. Again, it's a repeat of something else, and I don't personally like it, but I'll state it because it's in our book. It says, the first principle of success is that you should never be angry. Are you kidding, right? Even though your husband becomes unbearable and you have to leave him temporarily, you should, if you can, go without rancor. Patience and good temper are most necessary. And while you're at it, put your nun habit on and say some rosaries, and, you know, or if you're a man, put your priest collar on, and you know, it's a tall order. I understand the nature of it, okay, but ultimately that's not reality. It's just not going to happen. If we can get there, you know, believe it or not, if we can do these things and not be angry and be factual about it and kind of step aside and be able to detach, I mean, I've done it. I've experienced that. You know, really, it's not my problem. You know, because it always becomes, if they get you emotional, they win. Right? That's how it works. If you're sticking to logic and facts, they can't beat you. But man, they're looking. They're looking for that button that you may have disconnected. Oh, that one didn't work, and that one didn't work, and then, oh, and then they say that one thing that you've told them, don't ever say that to me. Right? Because they know. Like, as soon as they, don't ever say that. Okay, wait. Let me write that down verbatim, what I can never say to you. And then they do. And now you've looked. And they love it, because ultimately, they get to do what they want. Right? Now it's your fault. Because you yelled. It's your fault because you threw something across the room. That's why I drink. Right? It's not that you threw something across the room because they attacked your character and, you know, all that. It's never them, right? It's never an alcoholic. It's always you. So, ultimately, if we can get there, it really is. I mean, without anger is really the best way to handle a drunk. Without anger. However, we all know how difficult that really is, right? So we're almost as far as I wanted to get tonight, which is really quite exciting, because you know how long-winded I am, right? So I'm going to leave on this last sentence, though. This is important. It says, our next thought is that you should never tell him what he must do about his drinking. So let that sit in your head for a week, and then we'll keep going next week. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.